Ladies and gentlemen, I have spoken many times about Dante's, I have mentioned Dante's remark, writings are to be understood and should be explained chiefly according to four meanings. And this rule was generally accepted in the Middle Ages, and it applies wonderfully also to that great prolongation of the spirit of the Middle Ages, which is our theme tonight, and also to Shakespeare's other mature plays. And I was asked by someone to say a little more about these four meanings, so let me begin with a brief clarification of them in our present context. They are the meanings literal, allegorical, moral, anagogical. And this order rightly suggests a hierarchy, starting with the lowest and rising up to the highest. Now, I'll consider all four meanings briefly with regard to King Lear. It is a play about two old men, and its theme is preparation for death. Lear announces at the beginning, "'Tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our life, our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we unburdened crawl towards death." And without being so old or expressing any definite intention, the Earl of Gloucester, the other old man, says, and he is the central figure of what we might call the subplot or the second theme. He says in the second scene, "We have seen the best of our time, machinations, hollowness, treachery, and all ruinous disorders follow us disquietly to our graves." Now, in its literal meaning, this play is what might be called a morality play, of which the issue will be dying in a state of grace, such as will merit salvation. What then is meant by the moral meaning that Dante gives? And why does the moral meaning rank higher than the allegorical meaning? Well, before answering this question, which is important, let us consider the allegorical meaning. I should say, perhaps first of all, that the word allegory is understood in different senses. In Dante's sense, it clearly means what I shall say now. But the word itself could mean the highest meaning of all, the anagogical meaning. Allegory means saying something other than the literal meaning, that is, giving a meaning other than the literal meaning. That meaning could be allegorical in the ordinary sense, or it could be even the highest meaning. Whereas anagogy means giving a higher meaning, rising up to, leading up to a higher meaning. And that we shall consider later. But the allegorical meaning, in this lower sense, it serves to universalize the literal meaning, and so to guarantee its spiritual significance. But both are at the same cosmic level. But though the allegory does not transcend the human plane, it nonetheless expands it, sometimes to its full extent. And the discords of Shakespeare's great plays are suspended, as it were, between two harmonies, which in certain cases have to be identified, allegorically speaking, with the Edenic state and with the millennium. Now, King Lear, what takes place before the play begins is stamped with the seal of three. King Lear has three daughters. Three is a number of harmony, of course. We can say that the three daughters are like a triangle, with the apex, of course, Cordelia, and the two lower angles, Goneril and Regan. And that relative harmony can serve allegorically to equate the past with the Edenic age. Allegorically, I say, of course, not literally, in a sense. Whereas the end, that is the harmony at the end, that, of course, is always in different traditions to be preceded by an extremity of discord. The coming of the Antichrist, for example, in the three, at any rate in Christianity and Islam. And terrible things were predicted by Christ for signs of the coming of his second coming, that is, the millennium. And these terrible things are interpreted, equated by Gloucester, the Earl of Gloucester, more than once as being the signs of discord in the play. So that we are conscious always of a growing discord which is interpreted as being the approach of the end. So we have a reason allegorically for interpreting the play as the whole history, as it were, of the human race. And in fact, when we sit through a good performance of King Lear, we do have the impression, in a certain sense, of having witnessed the whole history of the human race, or having witnessed human history, shall we say. And the fall is reenacted in the first scene of King Lear by Lear's banishing his favourite daughter Cordelia and reducing the number three to two, that is, the number of inevitable discord, the number of the knowledge of the fruit of the forbidden tree, the knowledge of good and evil. Britain is left under the dominance of two instead of three. So we can say that the allegorical meaning serves as a vast and shadowy backcloth before which is enacted the drama of individual souls. This backcloth, few may be conscious of it, but many may be subconscious. And I would like to point out that we need really another word now in English. There's so much talk about the subconscious. And what I mean here is really superconscious. But nonetheless, subconscious has its rights as a word, because it may, the word sub, the prefix sub, may be used for depth instead of inferiority, as it usually is. It might be advantageous to have a word superconscious. And there are many things in Shakespeare's plays of which few are fully conscious, but in the theatre many perceive truths which they could subconsciously, which they could perceive in no other way. Now the moral message is placed above allegory because it concerns every level of meaning, and it is inextricably bound up with the highest meaning of all. But generally speaking, we can say that the ethical aspect of dramatic art can be said to concern the spectators insofar as they are drawn to identify themselves in varying degrees with whatever beauty of soul is put before them on the stage, and to dissociate themselves from all movements in the opposite direction. We must remember, I beg to remind you, that art is concerned with beauty above all. That is why I say beauty of soul, and that is what we feel in the moral message of Shakespeare. Now, as regards the moral message, against Lear's monstrous behaviour in the first scene, because his virtues develop rather slowly at the beginning, and he does behave as though all his vices were crammed, all his faults were crammed into that first scene. But until the virtues begin to develop, we must remember, we must put into the scales against those faults the fact that this man is no less than an object of profound devotion for three persons of altogether outstanding quality, namely Cordelia, Kent, and the Fool. They are all really devoted to King Lear, and that is something we must remember at the beginning, at any rate. Later on we come to understand. And these three, together with Edgar, that is Gloucester's legitimate son, Goneril's husband, the Duke of Albany, and we might add the King of France, who takes Cordelia to be his wife after Lear has banished her. The powers of darkness, these characters represent perfection in different degrees, and I would say, we could say that the summit of the hierarchy is in the two pearls of great price that were thrown away, one by Lear, the other by Gloucester, that is Cordelia and Gloucester's elder legitimate son Edgar. The servants of the powers of darkness are Goneril, Regan's husband Cornwall, and Edmund, the bastard son of Gloucester. And between these two groups of uncompromising opposites are Lear and Gloucester themselves. Unlike Hamlet and Othello, there is no personification of the devil in this play, but Shakespeare digs the four villains of the play, each one of them down to his or her hellish roots. And the most clear-cut of these is Edmund the Bastard, because he tells us more, he's more clear-cut, because he tells us a great deal about himself. The others don't speak about themselves, not in the way that he does. He introduces himself to us: "Thou, nature, art my goddess. To thy law my services are bound." And this means, as he goes, that we can deduce from what he goes on to say, that he is an atheist and that he's prepared to adapt the law of the jungle to life. He's not slow to act. Already in the second scene of the play, by forgery and lies, he succeeds in turning his father completely against his legitimate elder brother, Edgar. Now, of course, Gloucester's great fault is, one of his great faults is lack of discernment. He should have known the value. He tells us at the beginning of the play that although Edmund is a bastard, because Edmund we see in the very first, when the curtain goes up, we see with his father and the Earl of Kent, and Gloucester is introducing Edmund, his bastard son, to the Earl of Kent. And he insists that he, although he is illegitimate, he does not prefer his elder legitimate son one jot to Edmund. He is equally fond of both. But the one is a saint, the other is a devil. And that is a grave fault, having seen them all their lives, that he should not have seen, should not have had any discernment between the two. So, having succeeded, when Edmund is left alone on the stage, he triumphantly comments, "A credulous father and a brother noble, whose nature is so far from doing harms that he suspects none, on whose foolish honesty my practices ride easy. I see the business. Let me, if not by birth, have lands by wit. All with me's meat that I can fashion fit." That last line means, "All is acceptable to me that I can blend to fit the circumstances. I'm prepared to do anything, in other words, if I can get what I want by it." He makes it a principle to be unprincipled. Like Iago in Othello, he has no sense of the sacred, and he is totally self-centered. But unlike Iago, he does not delight in evil for its own sake. He's prepared to do any evil, but not unnecessary evil. And that is why he is able to repent at the end of the play, unlike any of the other villains, because he has this, as it were, this principle of being unprincipled, this philosophy of life. And when he sees that philosophy crumble to ruins, that is what enables him to repent. Edmund's contempt for ordinary goodness as a form of weakness, because for him goodness is weakness, and that is shared fully by the three other representatives of evil: Goneril, Regan, and Cornwall. Goneril explicitly condemns her husband Albany's respect for the old king as milky gentleness. Like Edmund, they follow the jungle law of might is right, and they are totally unprincipled. They are all three cruel, more so than Edmund, who would commit any cruelty if it would serve his turn, but not unless. Edmund is far more intelligent than the other three. He makes a kind of philosophy of his ruthlessness. Get what you can, while you can, and how you can. The others simply follow their own ruthless natures. Of the two sisters, the elder, Goneril, is the more formidable, with more initiative and more cunning. But Regan amply makes up for this by following Goneril's lead, or her husband's as the case may be, and going one better, better in inverted commas, please. For example, in the first scene, when Leah asks his three daughters, which of you loves me most? And he asks them to declare their love, and Goneril, the elder, he asks first. And she says, sir, I do love you more than words can wield the matter, dearer than eyesight, space, and liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honour, beyond all manner of so much, I love you. Regan, when she is asked, goes on to say that she is of the same metal as her sister, only she comes too short. I profess myself an enemy to all other joys, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness' love. Now, it's not unnatural that Cordelia was unable to find words when asked, her turn came, what to say. And when the king asks her, what can you say? She says, nothing. And you know the play, I think. And he is so upset, so disappointed at having, because she was his favourite, and he expected to hear something wonderful from her. But one can see by these two first speeches how it was impossible for, and when he says, so young and so untender, she replies, so young, my lord, and true. And then he says, then let truth be thy dower. He will give her nothing, none of the country as a dowry, but let truth be her dower. And that is very significant, because she, whom he banishes, is the personification of truth and all other goodness, and he banishes this, all this, from the country. Well, now, to go on with Regan, that was one example, but when Goneril has told her father that he must dismiss half his 100 knights, because Leah had made it a condition in giving the two halves of the kingdom to his two daughters that he would retain the title, the name, and all the addition of a king. And that addition was understood to be that he would keep 100 knights with him. He would go monthly between the houses of his, or the palaces of his two daughters, and he would always have with him 100 knights who would be housed by them. And that was part of the agreement. But after only 2 weeks, 2 weeks later, Goneril tells her father that he must dismiss half his 100 knights and keep only 50. Therefore be desired by her who else will take the thing she begs, a little to disquantity your train. That's how she speaks to her father. 2 weeks later, having made these professions of love and respect, so on, when it comes to Regan, the king says he has still one daughter who loves him. He leaves Goneril's house, goes off to Regan. And Goneril follows him there to make quite sure that Regan doesn't... The two sisters, of course, two is a number of discord. One is given the impression that although they are useful allies, the one to the other, and the same with their husbands, Shakespeare tells us as a sort of undercurrent throughout the play. It never comes to anything, but people say, we are told in more scenes than one, there is rumour of brewing wars between Albany and Cornwall. And it would have come to that in the end, in any case. But the events of the play move too quickly for that. But Goneril follows the king to Regan's house in order to make sure that Regan follows her advice, but she doesn't need to fear that. When Regan is faced with the problem, she says, I will only take 25. You must reduce your knights by a quarter, not only by half. And then Lear turns to Goneril and says, 50 is better than 25. You are better than I will go back to you. And then she says, Goneril says, what need you 25, 10 or 5? And Regan says, what need 1? She always goes better. The only time she didn't go better was when Goneril took the initiative to poison her. She couldn't go better than that because she was dead. Then another example, when Cornwall puts Kent in the stocks, saying, there shall he sit till noon, Regan says, till noon, till night, my lord, and all night too. And when, on Goneril's initiative, Cornwall sets out to blind Gloucester and has already put out one of his eyes, Regan says, one side will mock the other too. Put out, that is, put out the other two. But let us consider this briefly, this particular representation of evil, which might be said, from the anagogical point of view, to mark, in a certain sense, the lowest point of hell as regards the play. And let me remind you of one or two details, as I'm sure you all know the play. But when Regan has said, what need one, to Lear, referring to his knights, he makes his famous speech, O reason not the need. Our basest beggars are in the poorest thing superfluous. And he goes on he prays the gods to give him patience. And then he goes out, finally, saying to the fool, O fool, I shall go mad. This is the beginning of his sense that he is in danger of going mad. Gloucester, Kent, and the fool follow him out quickly, and we hear the sound of thunder in the distance, which increases. And Gloucester comes back very distressed about the plight of the king. The more Gloucester, it's to be noted, the more Gloucester comes in contact with evil, the better he becomes, as it were, by contrast. It is part of his descent into hell from the highest, from the point of view of the anagogical meaning, as we shall see. He is very distressed about the plight of the king, but Cornwall and Regan order him to shut the doors of his castle and to let no one in. And then inside the castle we see Gloucester alone with his son Edmund, and he confides to Edmund, alack, alack, Edmund, I like not this unnatural dealing. When I desired their leave that I might pity him, that is the king, they took from me the use of mine own house, charged me on pain of their perpetual displeasure, neither to speak of him, entreat for him, nor in any way sustain him. Most savage and unnatural, says Edmund. And Gloucester tells him also of a letter he has just received and locked in his closet. And we presume from what he says that it is from, it has to do with France, and there is rumour that the French are coming to England. And then he tells Edmund to entertain Cornwall and Regan while he goes out and try to keep their attention so that they won't notice his absence, while he goes out to try to help Lear. But having got rid of his brother, Edmund now sees a wonderful opportunity of getting rid of his father. He says in soliloquy, "This courtesy forbid thee shall the Duke instantly know, and of that letter too. This seems a fair deserving, and must draw me that which my father loses, no less than all. The younger rises when the old doth fall." He tells Cornwall everything, making a great show of distress on account of the tension between his filial affection and his loyalty. But loyalty wins. Cornwall makes him Earl of Gloucester and promises to punish his father. And meantime, Gloucester gives shelter to Lear, Kent, and the Fool, and his son Edgar, disguised as a madman, because Edgar is outlawed and the price is put upon his head, and he can do nothing but disguise himself as a poor mad beggar, which he does. Then Gloucester finds them a room, he gives them shelter in an outhouse, and then he comes back to the castle, and he hears from someone a rumour that Cornwall and Regan plan to put the king to death. So he immediately goes back to the outhouse and tells them they must leave at once, and he arranges for a litter to be brought for the king, who has gone to sleep, and arrangements are made for him to be taken to Dover. And on the way out, some of Lear's knights, who had followed him to Cornwall's castle, arrive, and they take charge of the king, and they take him off to Dover. And then Gloucester himself remains behind, quite unawares that Edmund has betrayed him. The letter that he had received contained simply news that the French army had landed, but nothing more. Cornwall has the letter in his hand, and he gives it to Goneril and tells her to go home with all speed and give it to her husband. He sends out some servants to seek out the traitor Gloucester. At the mention of Gloucester, Regan exclaims, "Hang him instantly." But Goneril says, "Pluck out his eyes." And Cornwall thinks that is a good idea. Evidently, he says, "Leave him to my displeasure. Edmund, keep you our sister company." That is Goneril. You go off with Goneril. "The revenges we are bound to take upon your traitorous father are not fit for your beholding." So Goneril and Edmund go out. Goneril, one might say at this point, is already in love with Edmund, and Regan has noticed this. She tells us in an earlier scene. Perhaps I should mention that Edmund tells us that he himself, simply in pouring scorn on the traditional ideas that astrology or birth or anything like affected one's character, he believes that we are what we are simply, and he says ironically, "My father compounded with my mother under the dragon's tail, and I was born under Ulster Major, the great bear." Therefore I am coarse and lecherous. I am rough, not coarse. I am rough and lecherous. Fat. I would have been what I am had the maidenly star of the firmament twinkled upon my bastardizing. But he knows that he may have made advances, we don't know, to Goneril, but in any case, as you know, later on, Cornwall dies and Regan is a widow, and both sisters are passionately in love with Edmund, who swears his love to both of them and is just waiting to see which will be the most opportune to take, or possibly neither, as the case might be. Well, they go out, Gloucester is brought in, and Cornwall says, before he comes in, that we cannot put him to death without a trial. Yet our power shall do a courtesy to our wrath, which men may blame but not control. Gloucester is brought in and pinioned to a chair, interrogated. Where hast thou sent the king? And he says, to Dover. Wherefore to Dover, says Regan. The question is repeated by Cornwall and reiterated savagely by Regan. And Gloucester is driven by the sense of outrage to retort. Because I would not see thy cruel nails pluck out his poor old eyes, nor thy fierce sister in his anointed flesh stick boarish fangs. And he ends, but I shall see the winged vengeance overtake such children. And then Cornwall says, see it thou shalt never. Fellows, hold the chair. Upon these eyes of mine I'll set my foot. He puts out one of Gloucester's eyes, and Regan tells him to put out the other. Then it is almost as if the horror of the spectators communicated itself to the three spectators on the stage, that is, Cornwall's servants. The first servant takes Cornwall by the arm and says, hold your hand, my lord. I have served you ever since you were a child, but better service never have I done you than now to bid you hold. And Cornwall draws his sword on the servant, who draws his, and they fight, and he seriously wounds Cornwall. But Regan snatches a sword and runs the servant through from behind and kills him. Cornwall puts out Gloucester's other eye. And Gloucester cries out, where's my son Edmund? Edmund, enkindle all the sparks of nature to quit this horrid act. Then with glee, Regan gloats over him. Thou callst on him that hates thee. It was he that made the overture of thy treasons to us, who is too good to pity thee. And then Gloucester, having lost his eyes, in a flash he has seen the truth. Oh, my follies! Then Edgar was abused. Kind gods, forgive me that, and prosper him. Regan says to the servants, go thrust him out at gate, and let him smell his way to Dover. She leads the bleeding Cornwall out, and one of the two servants left comments, I'll never care what wickedness I do if this man come to good. And the other says, if she live long and in the end meet the old course of death, women will all turn monsters. And they go out planning to get the bedlam, that is, the disguised Edgar, to lead the blind man where he will. Now, to understand the moral message as well as the highest message of a work of dramatic art, especially of a tragedy, it is necessary to be aware of what we might call the alchemy of evil. According to all traditions, God is the sovereign good, to agathon, to use the Socratic term, and there can be no such thing as evil in his proximity, that is, in the transcendent worlds of the spirit, the heavens with their paradises. There can only be evil after a certain distance has been reached, that is, after the boundary separating heaven and earth has been crossed. Here below, evil appears to be on an equal footing with good. But that is an illusion. All good on earth is a reflection of the supreme good.